Blog Talk Radio.
To another episode we have here of Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb. We have a fabulous show for you today. 2 hours of Suspense Radio coming up, starting off with the writing team collaboration of Michael Stanley. We're going to have on here Stanley Trollope and Michael Sears, followed by Ted Kabasta, Richard Mabry, and Debbie Vigge. So 2 hours, Suspense Radio, and anything else that's going on in the publishing world is going to begin right now. Everybody, to this glorious Saturday morning, listening to us live, or whether you're listening to us archive, wherever you listen to us, we appreciate you and all that you guys do for our support. It's great to be able to bring to you these great authors that we have today. And like I said, we're going to be starting off today with our first guest writing combination. The book came out, Deadly Harvest. It's the fourth book in their Detective Kubu series. It's the writing team of Stanley Trollope and Michael Sears creating Michael Stanley. Like I said, the book came out April 30th, so we want to thank both of them for coming on to the show. So Stanley and Michael, thanks for coming on. How are you guys doing today?
Glenn, thank you, and it's a great pleasure to be on your program.
Thank you so much.
So like we said, so this is the fourth book in your series. The book came out April the 30th, Deadly Harvest, with your character, Detective Kubu, bringing in also, you know, another kind of characters you have coming on. Give everybody a little bit, if you can, if they're not familiar with the story, maybe a little backstory leading up to the book Deadly Harvest, and then what you got in store here for the fans in Detective Kubu.
Well, Deadly Harvest is the fourth of our series, as you said, and each one of our books has got a backstory which is current in Southern Africa today. So in the case of Deadly Harvest, the backstory is around the pervasive power and influence of witchcraft in Southern Africa, in fact, generally in Africa. And what this means is that most people in Botswana actually have some fear or residual concern about what witch doctors can do. And a few of these witch doctors, most are herbalists and people who treat ailments and are respected and useful, but a few of them are really bad and dabble in black magic, and the worst of these, the worst evil of these witch doctors is that they'll abduct people and murder them and use the parts of the person as part of their potions, their magic potions. And the idea of this is to try and transfer a power from the victim to the user of the potion. And this is really hard for the police to deal with because there's no obvious connection between the victim and the murderer, a bit like the serial killer story. And mm-hmm. also, even the police themselves, and certainly any witnesses or anybody who might know something about the case, are really scared of the witch doctors themselves. So it's very difficult to get people to come forward and give reports and give evidence. So that's the backstory of this particular book.
The main character in our books is a detective in the Botswana police. And his nickname is Kubu, which in the local language means hippopotamus. And if you have ever seen a hippopotamus or photographs of hippopotami or hippopotami or whatever it is lying on the banks of a river, they look very placid. But I suspect many of your readers or listeners don't know that hippos kill more people in Africa than any other mammal. And so that sort of is a picture of our protagonist as well. He seems to be very placid. He's a very big man. He enjoys his food. But when he is on a mission to catch a murderer or somebody like that, you would not want to get in his way.
So, you know, now the one thing, of course, over here in the States, when you think of, you know, witchcraft and things like that, you always go to, you know, there's a lot of cities over here, like New Orleans is a big one. You wouldn't think of something like that maybe happening into southern Africa or Botswana. Is that something that, you know, you had to go and research and were kind of intrigued by what was going on down there? And that's when you decided that you had to kind of write about all of that. I mean, what kind of community is there going on down in, you know, South Africa for, you know, witchcraft, you know, black magic, things like that?
Well, the sort of the witchcraft that we're talking about is mainly fine and through the traditional healers that Michael mentioned. But but this type of witchcraft, if you call it that, is pervasive all the way in sub-Saharan Africa. And what our books have all done is take a backstory of some contemporary issue in Botswana and then write an entertaining mystery on top of it. And so the first book, A Carrion Death, had a backstory of blood diamonds. The second book, The Second Death of Goodluck Tinubu, looks at the problems of the civil war in what is now Zimbabwe and the people who fled that and crossed the borders into Botswana. The third book, Death of the Mantis, deals as the backstory with the plight of the Bushman peoples in southern Africa. They've got the rawest deal of anybody, I think, and have been squeezed by both the black groups coming in from the north and the white groups coming from the south. And this wonderful group of people have been squeezed into some of the most inhospitable terrain on the planet in the Kalahari Desert.
As far as the actual research for this particular book was concerned, it actually, the first idea for the book arose when we were writing our first book, A Carrion Death, and we made contact with the director of the Criminal Investigation Department in the Botswana Police, and he spent the afternoon with us and chatted to us about many different aspects of the culture and the police work in Botswana. And he mentioned a real case of a young girl who had been abducted for this witchcraft use, and her body was found some months later. It caused such a stir in the area where she had been living because of the fact that the local people felt that the police were not either not taking it seriously enough or even worse, protecting the perpetrators and the users of this medicine that resulted from it. So eventually the government had to call in they decided the best thing to do to try and calm what was going on in the area was to call in Scotland Yard from London and to get them to write a report, presumably to clarify all these things. And they did that. But that report has never been released. So, of course, there's a lot of concern about what was in it. And he told us the story and said, you know, this is something you should write about. And it's been sort of in the back of our minds since then. And this book, in some sense, is the result of that.
And I want to remind everybody, we're speaking here with author Michael Stanley, the combination of Stanley Truppo and Michael Sears. And they are the authors of the Detective Kubu books, and Deadly Harvest is their latest, which came out April 30th. You can go to Detective Kubu, KUBU.com, to find out a lot more information. Now, the one thing that you also did here is that within Deadly Harvest, you introduced a new detective that was part of the Botswana Criminal Investigation Department. Her name is Samantha Kamba. Now, how does she kind of work herself into, you know, the lives or kind of intriguing into the story with Detective Kubu? Was this something, was she a character that you had an idea that you maybe wanted to write before the book, or did she kind of come about in the developmental stages during the plot and the whole idea conception of Deadly Harvest?
One of the things when one writes a book like this is you're always trying to obviously find new things, and the other is you're always trying to find or create situations in which there is tension. And the Botswana Criminal Investigation Department, as far as we know, is an all-male organization. And so it was an obvious way to introduce tension into that department by having a woman be the first detective there. And then in order to make that tension even sharper, she's a very, very focused woman. And because of some issues in her background, she wants very much to address the issues of these young girls being abducted and murdered for these magic potions. So she's very pushy. And as you and many of your listeners know, that pushy women going into all-male organizations, the men don't really like that. And so that adds a whole new dimension of tension within the story. And Kubu himself, who regards himself as a sort of new-age modern man, finds himself being challenged by this rather aggressive young woman.
Well, we think that's been an interesting development for our series, and we think that Samantha's going to probably be in future books. We've always had a sort of foil for Kubu in each one of the books, but she seems to have developed into a strong character that we'd really like to take further.
So that was going to be my next question, was you, when you're kind of writing and you kind of see the dynamic between Kubu and Samantha, did it kind of come out a little surprising that you kind of realized that the two of them really worked very well together, and now you're like, hey, you know, this is something going forward that we feel that we should explore a little further?
Yes, I mean, I think that's exactly right. It's always a bit of a surprise when you're writing a book just how the characters develop and how they interact with each other. We certainly knew, as Stan just mentioned, that in Deadly Harvest, it was going to start out with quite a lot of friction between them because of the circumstances and because of the way in which the case would arise. But that over time, although that friction wouldn't disappear because they are very different people, they would be able to align it in such a way that it would help with the investigation rather than delay it.
Yeah, that's the one thing that's always intriguing is when you're writing and you're wrapping these things up. And, you know, character development in today's stories, while it's always been important, it seems like there's been an extra emphasis going on in today's things, because there's been so many plots that have already been written and maybe redone that you have to work so much harder now on developing your characters. And is that one of the biggest challenges that you always face when you guys sit down to write another book?
Well, we think that if you're writing a series like we are, in which the main characters appear in each of the books, the character has to really appeal to the reader. And if the character that you develop, the main character, is sort of just wishy-washy, the series is just going to wither and die. And so it's very important not only to have a protagonist who the readers enjoy, but is to also have people around him or her the readers can identify with. And certainly from my point of view, I think the readers that have commented to us about Samantha have come back more strongly, positively, than I had expected. And I think that's because they identify with the difficulties that she has moving into an all-male organization.
So then, when you look back at your previous books and you see, kind of how, when you go back to the beginning of Kubo and how he's kind of worked himself up in the Deadly Harvest, now the latest one, would you say that his transformation or how he's kind of worked himself up has been like more of like an unexpected turn? Has it been something that you have consciously thought about while the books go on, or do you not really think about that when you're writing the next book and it just kind of happens to just be the way that it is, more so than less?
Well, that's a very good question. Actually, to go right back to the beginning, Kubo wasn't even going to be the protagonist of the first book that we were writing. We'd actually, the first book starts out with an ecologist, a professor at the university in Khabarovni, and a game ranger coming across a body that's being eaten by hyenas. And the ecologist starts making deductions about what's happened to this body. And our idea was that he was going to be the protagonist, because we've both been university professors in our time, and they say you're supposed to write about what you know. So we thought, oh, well, a university professor solving an interesting crime would be an intriguing way to address the novel. But, of course, you always need a policeman in a situation where there's a murder, and so the camp near where this body is discovered phoned through to the police, and it was Kubo who got the job of going out and investigating it. And he got in his Land Rover and he had his sandwiches with him to make sure he wasn't too hungry on the trip. And he had his opera with him, and he started thinking about things, and he headed off into the bush. And by the time he got to the murder scene, he'd taken over the book, and that was a big surprise to us, but a very happy surprise, I must say. The poor ecologist sort of got relegated to the background in that situation.
It was also a big surprise to us, because this was our first book, and we thought that we were in control of the book. And it turned out that Kubo took control and said, I'm the main character, thank you very much, so continue with me.
Beyond that, Kubo has developed through the different books. And I think, as you said, it's partly conscious that you're thinking about the characters all the time. As time goes on, you know more about them because they have real history now, in the sense that what's written in book one has got to be part of the background of what happens later on in the series. But beyond that, we also find that there are things that just occur, and those things, perhaps the way Kubo reacts to Samantha, it's not quite what we would have expected if we'd planned it all out. It happens in the writing, and it happens, as you know, if you don't, if the characters talk to each other and it doesn't sound convincing, then you can't make it happen.
Now, for fans that are new to the series and they're just kind of finding out about Detective Kubo and your work, would you suggest that they kind of go back and start at the beginning with the series, or can they kind of jump into Deadly Harvest and then kind of work themselves their way back up to be able to, you know, get into the character? What would you recommend that they do?
I think if you are going to get into a series, it's probably better to start at the beginning, because then you can watch the protagonist evolve and develop over time. But we have written all four books as standalone books. And we're told constantly that when people pick up one of the later books as their first book, that it really makes no difference at all. Personally, I like to read series in order because I like to look at character development. But there is there's nothing in Deadly Harvest, the fourth book, that's going to give away anything in the previous books, for example. So I think either way, and I think that ends up being a personal preference.
Yeah, I think that that's one of the things, too, as you hit it, is the personal preference of, you know, how you decide to go back. But the good thing is that each book that you've done wrapped up within its own kind of mystery and its own kind of plot. And now if they go ahead and start with Deadly Harvest, they're able to see Samantha coming in that's new and maybe going forward. And because now that you are within book four, now that you maybe have the two together, have you thought about going forward not just, you know, with the two characters, but kind of how the dynamic is going to have to be if you split them kind of apart and make them almost like, you know, co-protagonists going forward?
Well, that's an interesting question. We thought about it just a little bit because we're thinking about a plot for the next book, which may require one of the characters to step back a bit and leave the field more to the other character to drive the case forward. And so if that happens, there will be, again, the parallel development of the two characters, and presumably as Samantha gets more experienced and more confident in what she's doing, that in itself is going to drive some interaction between her and her superiors, given the sort of person that she actually is.
And that also will probably create additional tension within the police force, because a lot of traditional men don't like seeing young women becoming very successful. One reviewer of Deadly Harvest actually suggested that we consider a separate series with Samantha as the protagonist, which was quite an interesting idea from our point of view, because we hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, a lot of the times you will see that some of those characters that you start writing about, those are the ones that the readers take away from, and you're like, well, I had no idea that that character would be so popular, and then you start thinking more about it, and that's always the fun part when you start seeing reader reaction or reviewer reactions to your books, is what are they going to pick out that is important to them that you are just kind of just taken back going, I had no idea that's the part they were going to take out of the book.
Yes, that's always great fun. We're actually phoning in from Bethesda. We're at the Malice Domestic Conference here, and we really enjoy these things tremendously because there's so many readers, and they're usually quite picky readers and quite insightful ones, and they come and talk to us about the books and what they liked and what they don't like and so on. And so we find that's really great.
We would certainly invite any of your listeners to contact us through www.detectivepubu.com, because we love calling in to book clubs who are reading our books, because it turns out that we learn a lot about our books that we didn't know either.
That's true. I mean, and do you notice a difference in, you know, like European, because South Africa is very European style. Do you see a difference between, you know, very much a European style reader compared to like a North American style reader, and the two things that maybe are a big contrast difference, in plots and characters and developments and emotions that they like and that they take away from books?
Yeah, I think there is a difference, and I mean, obviously generalizing is a terrible thing, but I think there are a lot of mysteries, detective stories set in North America that have hard-boiled detectives who are divorced and have a tough love life and maybe drink too much and so on, and the books are very action-packed, move very quickly. Our books, and certainly quite a few books out of the UK, for example, tend to be just a little bit slower, and a little bit more time is spent on, I think, character development, the development of relationships between people. And for example, in our books, one of the things we want to do is to portray the family life in Botswana. And so even in the midst of a horrible crime scene or crime detective chase, criminal, you know, when Kubu's after a bad criminal, he will try always on a Sunday to go and visit his aging parents. And then we try to build into that visit some insights from his parents into what may have caused the crime or who the crime may be, or provide some cultural background that will help Kubu. So it slows the pace down for a chapter, maybe a short chapter, before it picks up again. And I think that's not as common in North American mysteries.
Yeah, I think that you can definitely see the difference. And let's just, if you just go back to, you know, the Agatha Christie Sherlock Holmes and then compare it to the American detectives and, you know, more of the European to the American style, it's definitely a bigger contrast in things that we see. So, but now we got about a minute left. So can you kind of let us know in a minute, maybe what's going on in the future, if events you're going to be at, news and things like that, that you maybe have upcoming that you kind of want to let people know to find out a lot more about your writing in your world?
Well, we've got a number of book events coming up in the next few weeks because, as you said, Deadly Harvest has just come out. There's a list of them on our website under events at www.detectivekubu.com. So people can follow us there.
And your Facebook members, listeners, can also get the information from our fan page, which is facebook.com/Michael Stanley Books. And obviously we'd love to see people join that and find out what's happening to Kubu and where we will be appearing for events.
Well, I'll tell you what, guys, we want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about your, you know, your character and everything you got going forward. It's always fascinating just to see, you know, the kind of new developments and things that, you know, that people have going on. And you're bringing a lot, you know, another kind of character here now to the party. And it's great to be able to speak with you about it. I want to thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Much appreciated.
All right, you guys have a good day, and we will speak with you later.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So again, everybody, that is author Michael Stanley teamed up with the combination of Stanley Trollope and Michael Sears to create Michael Stanley. You can find them at Detective Kubu, KUBU.com. The fourth book in the series, Deadly Harvest, is out now, and it's not one that you kind of have to read in order. You can kind of go back and get it all in. But you see the intricacy that they wrap these characters around. And that's what makes us love these mysteries and, you know, these thriller books. So I definitely recommend that you go and you check them out. We are going to be back here right after this break with our next guest. I'm going to apologize to him now because I know I'm going to mess up his last name. And when we get off there, I'm going to figure this one out. But it's Ted Kosmatka is what I'm going to guess on this one, Kosmatka. And he is going to be on to talk about his latest book called Prophet of Bones. So stick right with us, and we will see you in a couple minutes. So welcome back, everybody. And again, we want to thank author Michael Stanley, the writing combo there, for their interview talking about their latest book, Deadly Harvest. But now we're going to transition here into our next guest. He is the author of the latest book called Prophet of Bones. His name is, like I said, and I actually got it right, and it's Ted Kosmatka. I almost screwed it up, though. So we want to thank Ted so much for coming on and talking to us today. So, Ted, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing good. Good. Thanks for having me on the radio show. I appreciate it. This is actually my only my second time ever being on the radio, so I apologize if I'm a little nervous, but thanks a lot for having me.
No problem. No need to be nervous whatsoever, because you have yourself here a very interesting concept book with your character, Paul Carlson, who's a scientist. So you're kind of bringing into the world of, you know, I guess you wouldn't really say the science fiction, because when people think science fiction, they think fantasy. And, of course, today is May 4th, so happy Star Wars, everybody. So you basically have a science thriller book, though, which is something that is a little different. Tell everybody a little bit about maybe Prophet of Bones and Paul Carlson and the concept maybe like behind the book.
Well, I felt sorry for the people in charge of marketing this book, because I know there was a lot of discussion about what kind of category to put this book in, because like you said, it is very much a science thriller, but then it's also definitely an alternate history. So the general premise is it's set in a world where young Earth creationists were right. So the book came about because of a discussion. I was actually worked in a laboratory for about 8 years by the time I wrote this book. And I was working in a laboratory, and a friend of mine who actually worked in the lab with me, we were discussing things, and it during the course of our conversation, I realized that he actually was a young Earth creationist. And that fascinated me, because here we were working with electron microscopes and, you know, worked in this scientific laboratory, but he had this totally different worldview than me. And I realized that, you know, although, you know, we had the same job and we were, you know, we hung out all the time and we, you know, played basketball, you know, after work and spent a lot of time together, it was almost as if we were living in two completely different worlds. And, you know, in his world, the Earth was 5,800 years old, and in my world, you know, billions of years old. And I could sort of understand, you know, where he was coming from. I grew up in a very, you know, religious household, and so I definitely had that in my background. And then I was so fascinated, I decided, well, I want to write a novel that's set in his world. You know, I want to write a novel that's set in a world that's only 5,800 years old, but nothing else gets to change, right? No, I'm not going to cheat anything else. So all the science has to be our science. So all the fossils that are in the ground, they have to be the same fossils we have. So there's still Neanderthals, there's still Homo erectus, there's still Australopithecus, there's still, you know, there's still this great body of, you know, this wealth of scientific knowledge is out there, except that now it's in the context of a world that's 5,800 years old. And, you know, during the course of thinking about this book and starting to write it, I realized it's actually far more disturbing, I think, of a worldview to think that the world is that young, and then to try to explain all these things, because the explanations, they in a lot of ways are more disturbing than the scientific explanations we have now, you know. And around this time when I was coming up with, you know, how I was going to tell the story, there was a lot of stories on the news about Homo floresiensis in the island of Flores in Indonesia, the so-called hobbit fossils. So these are the fossils of hominins that were about 3.5 feet tall. They're sort of like these surprising, shocking fossils. And there was a lot of argument that was going on about what exactly these fossils represented. And I thought to myself, well, if scientists in our timeline are so viciously fighting over what these fossils could possibly be, imagine if the world was 5,800 years old, how much more vicious that fighting would become. You know, what would, you know, then you're faced with these things that have all kinds of, I mean, there are other implications you have to take into account, you know, the religious implications, worldview implications that are involved in, you know, the meaning of these fossils. And so once, you know, once I glommed onto that, I realized, boom, there's the story I want to tell. So the story is actually set in a world where creationists were correct, and they discovered these fossils on the island of Flores. And so it follows basically a laboratory analyst, a gene tech, so to speak, where he goes to this island to help on this archaeological dig, and his goal is to get DNA samples from these fossils. And, of course, you know, things go horribly wrong in a lot of ways, and then it's, you know, things do not go well for him after that.
And so, I mean, it's a very in-depth kind of thriller book. I mean, it really makes the person have to think about, you know, I mean, it's just a lot more than just a plot and a lot more than just a character. It's kind of everything wrapped together. So when you have Paul Carlson as your protagonist, it almost seems like that you decided, hey, you know what, we're going to have the story before the character. So how were you able to kind of create your character, Paul, and, you know, get him wrapped up within this story that you decide to create?
Well, so someone asked me once, you know, how much research or what research I did in order to you know, write the book. And sort of the answer I came up with was, you know, my entire life has been research for this book. You know, every when it comes to Paul, it's like I, in a way, I sort of was this kid who was, you know, fascinated or maybe even obsessed with science from an early age. And, you know, like I said, I grew up in, you know, a religious household. You know, I was an altar boy. And so I, as a child, you know, I was sort of like bombarded with these two different worldviews, you know, the religious worldview and then, you know, the more scientific worldview. And so it didn't even occur to me to write the book differently than I did. I mean, when it became, you know, when it was time to, you know, come up with a character to begin the story and I came up with Paul, I more or less just wrote from, I guess, my own conflicts as a kid, you know, when I was trying to make sense of these two different worldviews that I was being exposed to. So I guess in a lot of ways, you know, he was, you know, a lot of his struggles were just, you know, my struggles whenever I was a child. So I wrote from experience in that case.
Yeah, I mean, when you're looking, and again, I just want to remind everybody here that we're speaking with author Ted Kosmatka, and it's Kosmatka, Ted.com, if you want to find out a lot more information at TedKosmatka.com. And so when you have the book and you're trying, and I guess the hardest thing is not only, of course, writing the book and getting it all together, and when you're having your character Paul and you have all these things in the science that you've been, you know, working on for so long, one of the hardest parts is when you brought it to an agent or you brought it to a publisher. What was kind of one of the backlashes or the things that you started hearing? I mean, how long did it kind of take it before you were able to, you know, get the book published?
Well, my first book, it was definitely a huge, huge struggle. I mean, it was I'm definitely not one of those writers who picked up a pen, wrote a story, and then, you know, 2 months later had a book contract. I mean, I basically wrote from the time I was in middle school. You know, I started writing, and I got more serious about it in high school. And then whenever I was in college, of course, you know, I was writing pretty constantly then. And I wrote literally for 10 or 15 years before I had even the slightest glimmer of anyone saying anything I was writing was any good. So
right.
I had this drawer. I remember reading Stephen King's On Writing, and he talked about having this spike where he would put his rejection slips, and that sort of like gave me encouragement, you know, whenever I was writing stories and sending them out and getting rejected. And so I had this drawer that I was filling up with my rejection slips. I figured, oh, Stephen King has this spike on the wall, I have this drawer, you know, he actually managed to make a career out of writing, so, you know, there's hope for me. And I reached this point, though, where I had so many rejections that I couldn't shove any more inside the drawer. The drawer was literally full in my desk, and it's like I was like trying to cram, and I realized, oh my God, I can't fit a single more rejection. And that was sort of the point when I thought to myself, well, gosh, you know, I think I just must be totally wasting my time with this writing thing, because Stephen King didn't have a second spike, right? You know, it's like, I just didn't have the gumption to actually start a second drawer. So I actually stopped submitting for a little while. But I found I couldn't stop writing. So what I would do is I would write, and then I would write without the idea that I would actually ever submit the stuff. And I write because, you know, I'm one of those people, it's like how I keep my mental stability or whatever. I'm I always feel better when I write something. So I wrote this one particular short story, and I finished it, and I thought, well, that was nice. And then I thought, well, you know what, I think I am going to send this one. I'll just collect a rejection for it. You know, I don't have a place to store my rejection. Maybe I'll just throw it away now. But I figured I'll just go out, I'll send it out, and I'll collect a rejection for it. So I sent it out, and that was actually my first sale to Osmonds Magazine. That happened in 2005. And they sent the acceptance in. And I think everything that has happened since then has sort of grown out of that very first short story acceptance. So I started writing when I got the acceptance in, it just changed everything. And so I just went full blast into writing, and I wrote a bunch more stories, and then suddenly those were getting accepted, and then my stories were started getting reprinted in the Year's Best anthology. Several different editors started reprinting my stories, and they were started being translated into other languages. It was in Russian, Hebrew, Japanese, Chinese. It just started going sort of crazy, and it was and after trying for so long to sell my stories and not be able to, it was suddenly like this door had opened up, and so then I thought, well, you know, the next logical step, right, is to work on longer things to see if I can pull it off. So I wrote a novel, and it was called The Games, and I sent that out, and that was rejected in a lot of places. And then ultimately, though, I was contacted by a fellow by the name of Seth Fishman, who was a literary agent, and he said he had heard about my short fiction, or had been told about my short fiction, and wanted to know if I had any novels done. And I said, well, yeah, actually I do, but, you know, it's been, I'm not sure if you'll want it, you know, I'll send it to you. And I sent it to him, and he said he thought he could sell it. And I said, well, if you think you can, you know, more power to you, or go ahead and try. And just a couple days later, he called me and said that he had actually had a lot of interest in the book, and, you know, I had a book contract. So that was my first novel. And then my second novel then, they actually, it seems like the publishing industry is very focused on series, you know, series of books. And when I finished The Games, to me, it was done. You know, I didn't have anywhere else that I was, like, super excited to go to. But then I did have this idea in my head, you know, about this book, The Prophet of Bones. So I wrote that, and I sent it to my agent, and, you know, he was able to very quickly sell that too. So there really wasn't very much resistance to it. But the one thing was the confusion about how exactly it should be marketed. You know, there definitely were some conversations about that.
Yeah, because, you know, when people first pick it up, they're going to look, and they're just going to sit there, and it's great for you to be able to talk about it, because it's a very intricate topic. And so that's why when you have to sit there and you're putting your characters together and you already have the outline and the plot, the characters have to be just that much intricate as the story, and that can cause a lot of probably headaches within your own head as you're going through and trying to write a 370-page book to try to make sure you get everything out just the way that you want to get it out. And that's got to be very, you know, nerve-wracking for you.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, I'm definitely an outliner. So I had, when I wrote the book, excuse me, you know, I did have an outline, but it's amazing the way stories will tend to flex around outline. So you have this idea that this sort of like this path that you're going to be traveling along, but then you find all these sort of like interesting side paths that you want to explore, and so you end up sort of exploring the side paths. And every once in a while, the side path will actually become more interesting than the main path, and you realize, oh, this side path is the main path. I just didn't know it when I started. And so a lot of times that'll happen. And I think to some extent that happened a little bit in Prophet of Bones, especially like in the early part of the book. When I came up with the outline, you know, I definitely had a destination that I was aiming for, but the early part of the book was a little squishier in my head. So I started with the character, you know, Paul, when he was a boy, and he went in, he talked about mouse breeding and breeding his mice, and then there was the religious angle of all that, and then that sort of like took on a life of its own. It sort of became its own little subplot there at the beginning that I hadn't really anticipated, and it sort of all unrolled in a really interesting way. I was sort of happy with it. I'm like, oh, I didn't expect this to happen here right at the beginning, but then it did, and ended up being like its own little encapsulated sort of story.
Yeah, I mean, fans of Steve Barry, Nelson DeMille, and Clive Cussler are the people that are going to just get into your book, and those are the three main authors who wrote fabulous reviews. And I know that, you know, this is your second book and you're very new into the game and you're just kind of setting your foot into the water and maybe the tide now has hit your knees, so you're getting a little bit more involved into the game. But
right. You're
still trying to meander around and be able to have those three authors, you know, write about your work. It's got to be great. And how are you kind of now handling the whole fact of, like you said, this is only your second radio show, so you have to put yourself kind of out there into the world and get yourself out from behind the pages. How has that transition been? Because, you know, we kind of talked out there, and like you said, you're a writer first, and you're not really a speaker. So you're kind of having to learn both aspects of this whole funky little game we got going on here, don't you?
Yeah, that's sort of the terrifying aspect of it all. You know, it's like it's one thing to be sitting in, you know, in this sort of little basement room and, you know, staring at a computer screen and sort of creating these worlds and telling your stories. And you know, I think a lot of writers, the reason they write is because that's how they want to sort of interface with the world. You know, you're able to sort of like, you know, you want the world to sort of see your stories and sort of react to your stories. And so you don't really want or need or have that sort of desire in yourself to sort of like put yourself up on stage. And you know, for myself, it's definitely like that. I've always been comfortable sort of in the background, and I like the idea of my stories being out there, but as far as like me being on stage, I just don't feel like there's anything particularly interesting about me, so it's sort of like, it's hard, yeah, it's like being on a radio show, it's like, I no matter what, I have this moment where like, what am I doing here, why am I on the radio, you know,
right.
Like, what did I do to, for this to happen, so, but I guess, you know, it all comes back to the books, and it is all part of it, so, you know, I'm always happy to talk about the books and try to, you know, get some interest in them.
Yeah, and so have you kind of thought about, you know, when you go forward and, you know, as you progress kind of through, you know, this line of work? Because, I mean, I don't know, are you a full-time writer? Do you have a lot of authors, you know, you, of course, you actually have a job that pays the bills, and then you write for fun. Is that kind of what you do? I mean, are you a full-time writer? Is this what you do for full-time?
Well, what you just described is always sort of what I had anticipated happening. I thought I would have my job in the research lab, and I would write short stories and novels on the side. And that was sort of like my ambition. That's as far ahead as I looked. And it just hasn't worked out that way at all. So what actually happened was, based on my short story, I'll tell the short version of it. The short version is that I now work at Valve, a video game company, and so I was hired based on my short stories to come work at a video game company. Now I'm working on writing full time for a video game company. So I was born and raised in Indiana, so it was definitely like a big switch for me to move across country, and to now I'm living in Seattle, and I'm actually definitely not what I expected, but it's been fascinating, and I absolutely love it. So I guess right now my day job during the week I work on video games, and then at night I work on novels, and on weekends I work on novels, and that's sort of the way things have sort of unfolded for me.
Now, are you going to any events? Are you going to be voucher conning it, or you know, Thriller Fest, places like that, where people are able to kind of go out and meet you and talk with you and, you know, and get to a little bit, you know, get to know a little bit more about you as the person and the author. Are you out there for people to kind of meet?
I haven't really done that yet. I'm definitely not opposed to it. I always thought that at some point I would start doing things like that. It just sort of hasn't really happened yet.
I was thinking about going
to WorldCon later this year. I'm not sure. I haven't actually bought tickets for it though. So yeah, I haven't really done anything like that yet. I know I'm going to the Locus Awards in a couple months. So that'll be my next one. But I haven't really done any big signings or anything like that.
Nothing like that yet. So this is all just still a little bit new to you, and still just like I said, you're kind of feeling your way. Kind of through the process, but Prophet of Bones is going to be one of those books that is going to put you kind of into a spotlight that you might not be very familiar with. So I don't know if you kind of thought about that and how it's going to happen, because you know, when you get your book out there, and you know, and you're with a big publisher, you know, you're with HarperCollins, and so you're not with
Henry Holt.
Henry Holt, that's right, yeah. So,
yeah.
You know,
well,
when you're with a big publisher like that.
Yeah,
too many,
publishers.
Yeah, there's 85,000 of them. I lose track of who the hell I'm talking about. But, yeah, I mean, that's just kind of what you got going on. And like we said, we have a lot of authors that listen to the show. They love to hear these kinds of stories because, like you said, you just kept your nose to the grind and you got your book out there, you know, The Games. Now you got The Prophet of Bones out here. And so you just kind of moving yourself forward.
Yeah, it all feels like a little bit of a miracle that it happened. You know, if someone had asked me 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago, did I think any of this would happen, I would have said absolutely not. I mean, it's just been a total, yeah, it's definitely been a little bit of an exciting roller coaster ride. You know, and even the move out here to Seattle, I mean, it's just been definitely been unexpected.
Yeah, see, because we're based in L.A., and Seattle's one place I've not been able to get up to, but you know, I'm sure you're a member of the Pacific Writers Association, the Pacific Northwest Writers Association. They have a great event that comes there that they do, I think, right after Thriller Fest, like the end of July every year, and that's always a great one, one of the biggest ones on the West Coast. So that's something, if you've never been, that you should go look at.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, Pacific Northwest Writers Association is a great organization, and that's just another way, you know, that you can always kind of go and meet with fans and kind of get the idea, because when they contact you and they say, hey, you know, about the book or about your characters, what's one of the, I guess, FAQ questions that you seem to get a lot that you're kind of shocked that you get this question all the time about the book?
Well, one of the things I like about fan mail and about, I guess, science fiction fans in general is how particular they are, and it really keeps the writers on their toes, because I knew this. So growing up, I read a lot of Asimov's Magazine, Analog Magazine, Magazine of Science Fiction and Fantasy. Those are basically the three magazines I grew up with, and during a certain period of time, I know they stopped doing this at some point, and I don't remember which magazine in particular it was, or maybe it was actually all three at some time, but they would have these letters to the editor where it would basically be fans mailing in to point out inconsistencies or errors in the writer's stories, and always be like the most arcane sort of like, you know, somebody got out a calculator and had to spend like 45 minutes calculating that the orbit of this spaceship couldn't actually have been where the author says it was, or it would have intersected with. It's just like, it's like these people really know their stuff. And so that was always in the back of my mind whenever I started writing, because I thought, you know, if I make any kind of mistake in here, I will absolutely get zapped for it. You know, I will get letters. And so when I published my first novel, The Games, I actually did start getting these letters, and it was over, and I had been so careful on like all the genetic aspects of the novel, you know, because it's a genetics thriller, and but one thing I had apparently made this error in the decimal point, and whenever I was talking about the frequency that the creature in my book, the frequency that it could hear at, and so apparently mess up. And so I got all these letters from like acoustical engineers or sound engineers letting me know that like what I had written for this particular, it was like literally one sentence in my book that I screwed up on, and I got all these letters from acoustical engineers, yeah, sound engineers telling me I was wrong. So I was like, I had to promise them, all right, if it goes into reprint, I promise I'll fix it. And I haven't really gotten anything like that yet with A Foot of Bones, and I've sort of been waiting to see. And so I think, or maybe because, you know, I got all those letters from my first novel, I just went that extra mile and like double checked absolutely everything I could possibly think of that could be wrong. You know, I went back and double checked, and so far I haven't been zapped by any of the fans. But the letters I get usually are you know, they're very complimentary, you know, letting you know that, you know, the book meant something to them. You know, those are actually, as an author, those are the kinds of, you know, letters that really just make everything sort of worth it. You know, that's your goal. I mean, I think that's sort of like the highest compliment you could be paid as an author, is to have someone tell you that, you know, that your book meant something to them. So,
right. Well, I'll tell you what, Ted, we want to thank you so much for coming on. Fascinating concept book. You know, you're well on your way here to propelling yourself into this thriller category as to be one of those names that people are going to start watching every time to kind of see what you got coming out. So we want to thank you so much for coming on and speaking with us. And, you know, we would love to catch up with you in the future. So just stay in touch.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. And people can follow me on Twitter at tkazmatka.com, or they can follow me on Facebook, or, you know, you can swing by my website. I have a contact page there.
All right. Well, thank you again for coming on, Ted. Enjoy yourself.
All right. Thanks. Have a nice day.
All right. Bye-bye. Again, everybody, that is Ted Kosmatka, and his book is Prophet of Bones. It's tedkosmatka.com, K-O-S-M-A-T-K-A, to find out a lot more about what he's got going on. He's an up-and-comer to watch for and see what's coming on in the future with him. So keep your eyes peeled for what Ted's got coming out. We're going to take a short little commercial break here, and we're going to be back on with our next author. His name is Richard Mabry. He is a doctor. His book is called Stress Test. You are going to find out a lot of information here about this, because he is writing the Prescription for Trouble series, and very fascinating stuff that he's got coming on. So we are going to talk shortly, and in the meantime, you can listen to this one. So welcome back, everybody. I had a slight 20-second technical difficulty there. But, hey, I want to thank everybody for coming back here on the show. We are halfway through this two-hour episode of Suspense Radio. We've had some great guests on, and we're continuing the trend here with another great guest. He is author Richard Mabry. His latest book is called Stress Test. Many of you might know him from his previous. He had four books that were out in the Prescription for Trouble series, but now he's kind of broken away. He's on a brand new publisher. He's with Thomas Nelson. And Richard, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Doing great. Thank you for having me.
So, like I said, you kind of broke away there from Abington Press. Now you're kind of with Thomas Nelson in this brand new, not really series, but, you know, kind of brand new book that you got out called Stress Test. You got a brand new character, Dr. Matt Newman. He kind of got himself going in a little bit of a predicament going on. So why don't you give us a little bit about the book and kind of, you know, the concept and the characters behind it.
Okay, I appreciate that. And going to the new publishers, you know, you move from publisher to publisher. Sometimes you own a Chevrolet and decide you want to buy an Oldsmobile. But
yeah.
With this one, all these books are freestanding. And I will have to tell you that the inspiration for this book came to me while I was still at Southwestern Medical School as a professor. I walked into the faculty parking garage and thought, you know, if this were deserted and at night, it would be a great place for a kidnapping, and that's kind of where Stress Test started.
What's kind of scary is, real fast, is that you kind of went in there and said, wow, this is a great place for a kidnapping. So that's author blood right there, all right there. So, sorry, go ahead. I just had to say that because that's an author for you.
Well, you got to hear a bunch of us at a writer's convention in an elevator talking about how to kill somebody. Matt Newman thought he had it all together. He left what he thought was his last case in private practice at 2 o'clock in the morning, walked out into the parking garage of the medical center, and is kidnapped, thrown into the trunk of his car, and is to be taken for what he assumes to be his last ride. He manages to escape, but at the price of a head injury, and when he awakens in the ICU, he discovers that he is charged with murder. So that's kind of where things start, and I try to keep that amount of tension going throughout the whole book.
Now, would you kind of say that, I mean, is this a medical thriller in the way that, you know, I know that the character is a doctor, but it sounds like it's not as much as a medical thriller where, you know, you have a lot of the medical things that come about. It's more along the lines of you have your doctor set as the character, but it's not really the medical backdrop that's really the story behind it. Am I right with that?
Well, it's kind of 50-50. It is set in a medical setting, and, of course, Matt's practice has gone down the tubes. He has no way to earn money, and so he has to look for a way to get back into some sort of practice. And so there are medical vignettes and medical situations throughout the whole thing, but what drives it is the fact that, first of all, the police want to talk to him as a potential suspect in a murder, and secondly, he doesn't know why he was kidnapped, but he would like to find out who it was before they finish the job. So it's kind of a 50-50 situation. Now, in some of my previous books, I'll give you an example, Lethal Remedy, which was my fourth book, it actually had to do with a miracle cure drug, that had some hidden side effects, which had been hidden for financial reasons. And so most of that, the driving force was a medical situation. But in this one, as I say, it's about 50-50.
Now, for fans that read, you know, your last books, would you say that the pacing in this newest book, Stress Test, and again, I want to remind everybody that your website is rmabry.com, M-A-B-R-Y.com. Would you say that the pacing in this book is similar to what you used with your previous ones, or did you kind of change up a little bit? So are your older fans going to notice any kind of a change, or are they just going to know that it's the same great stuff that you already put out and it's kind of the same kind of pacing that you've always had?
Well, as you know, what an author talks about sometimes is his voice and the way he describes things and the pacing and so forth. And I think the voice is going to be the same in this. The pacing is the same. What I always try to do is to make every book better than the other, but and try to make them different so they're not cookie cutter. But I think that my fans, put it this way, the reviews that I have so far for Stress Test have been good, and my fans did not seem disappointed. So I'm happy with that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like we said, like we said off the air was, you know, you had, you know, Michael Palmer and Tess Gerritsen, you know, one of the two, you know, the two heavyweights, kind of in the medical maybe field, giving you just rave endorsements. I mean, that had to be just so, you know, gratifying to realize that you had two great authors that, you know, gave you basically the seal of approval, if you want to call it that.
Oh, this was great. Matter of fact, I'm in my office right now, and I printed off, Michael, bless his heart, gave me 6 different endorsements that could be used. And
wow.
My wife, bless her heart, printed this off and put it up here and said, now you look at this if you ever doubt your ability. But what really made me feel good was that both Michael and Tess endorsed this. My previous books had been endorsed by writers who were well-known in the Christian fiction, Christian medical fiction area, but these are people in the general fiction area, and I really respect what respect their opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it's not every day that, you know, you can get endorsements from those top people in the field, and fans of Tess and Michael are definitely fans that would, you know, that would get into your books. So give us a little bit in-depth detail. Like, if your character Matt Newman was kind of sitting right in front of you right now, what's some of the things that you would want to ask to find out a little bit more about him? That maybe that's what the fans and the readers would like to kind of know a little bit more about your character, Matt Newman.
Matt is a general surgeon, and he's been quite happy with his situation. He's a bachelor. But he's begun to get fairly serious about a particular woman, except she is giving him trouble about the hours that he keeps and demands on his time. So he has decided that going into academics might give him a little bit more freedom of time. And this is why he thinks this is his last case that he's walking away from at the hospital. When he gets into the situation he's in, he needs a lawyer, and he calls his girlfriend, who happens to work at the DA's office, and the first thing she does is, like a turtle, pull back into her shell, saying, I can't be associated with someone who is who's even under suspicion of murder. Think what it would do to my career. She gives him the name of a female lawyer who is supposedly very good, one of the best around, and he contacts her, not knowing that she has just broken up with another doctor, and she doesn't want to have anything to do with physicians or doctors or anything like that. So there's a lot of sparring back and forth between them. Matt is in a quandary. Not only is he under suspicion of murder, but as I said, his practice has been sold. He has no income coming in. He has no way to earn a living. And finally, he does get a job in an emergency room, and then, of course, has a number of adventures down there. So Matt is scrambling. He's scrambling both from a standpoint of profession, from a standpoint of the fact that the girl that he thought was going to be the one is distancing herself from him. His life basically has fallen apart.
So you would have, I mean, you wouldn't say that he's very, that he's not like he's flawed. He very much has he has a lot of issues that he has to work with. So when you're writing a character like that and you got to kind of keep all that together as you're going through, knowing that he has, you know, a lot of ailments, I guess you want to call them, how does that make it difficult for you writing the book as you're kind of going forward? Because you kind of have to progress that and bring out those kind of emotions and those kind of heartaches that he's feeling while he's wrapped up in this, you know, in this murder mystery and this kidnapping and being charged with murder. And now, you know, now he has this lawyer that's going on and he has all these other things happening.
Well, that's one of the problems that writers who really bury themselves in their work have. when I get ready to write a story, I populate it first. I think of who the characters are, and I give a little bit of the background and so forth. But the characters develop as I go along, and I may have to go back and rewrite several thousand words at the first part of the book because I say, no, that's not right. That's not what he would do. That's not the emotions he would have. And I will tell you very honestly, there are times when I'm writing some of the really, really tense moments in the book, I have a hard time sleeping. I have the same worries that Matt does.
So you kind of take a little bit of that emotion out of the character and bring it into yourself, which is probably what you do a lot with your writing, is you're bringing your emotion within to your character and seeing as how, you know, you are an MD, you have a lot of believability, and that's what the fans and the readers like to know about, is that when they read these kinds of things, and it's not like you're a lawyer writing about a medical field or a doctor writing about, you know, law, it gives a lot of the believability to your story, and I'm sure that that's what your fans really like to take away from it, because they know when they're reading something about the medical community, they know that it's true, and it's just not really fabricated.
That's true. One of the things that I really appreciate is when people recognize that I don't shy away from describing medical procedures and using medical terms, but I always manage to work in a definition or an explanation without it being too obvious, so they're never really lost. They don't really have to stop and look words up, and that means a lot to me if I can continue to do that. That's been very good.
Yeah, and when you're doing the dynamic of Sandra and Matt kind of together, did you kind of have an idea already about how you wanted to do it, or did it kind of come about a little bit differently than you thought it was going to be? How was that kind of dynamic working as you started putting, you know, the pen to the paper and getting the book stress test out?
Well, John, as you know, there are two types of writers. There are plotters and pantsers, the people who write from the seat of their pants and those who have a plot and know exactly where it's going to go. I basically start with the opening scene, the characters, a couple of high points, and how it's going to end. But often the characters will surprise me. And as I say, I have to go back and say, oh, they're not going to act that way, or wouldn't it be interesting if they do this? I'll also give credit to my wife. I get a lot of compliments because I'm able to write from the standpoint of the female protagonist or the female point of view. Kay is my first reader. She is my biggest fan and severest critic. She will often say, well, now, she wouldn't say that. She wouldn't feel that. She wouldn't do that. So between the two of us, we kind of see how the emotions go. But I'm sometimes surprised by the twists and turns that the plot takes.
Yeah, I that's one of the things, of course, like when we're writing and we're doing the magazine and you know, doing short stories, is you always get that when you're getting it down, and whether you outline it or whether you don't outline it, there's always some kind of characters or always something that comes up that shocks you. Who is the character or what kind of happened within the book stress test that maybe took you away from what your original intention was? That, you know, that kind of came out in the book that kind of made you go back and say, wow, I had no idea that this character was going to be this way.
Well, let me say this, and I'll try to say it without too much of a spoiler. There was one of the characters in the book that I expected to be very strong and to play a big part in it, and about two-thirds of the way through, I had to kill him. So,
yeah. Okay.
So that was a surprise. My friend James Scott Bell often tells the story that one of his editors fussed at him about having to kill off a character in one of his books, and Jim's answer was, "I didn't kill him. I found him dead."
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, the bad guys gave me probably more surprises than the good guys did.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk about kind of the villains. Is you know, a lot of the times when you're writing a thriller and a suspense book, of course, you know, when you have the protagonist, I mean, they kind of just, they're kind of straight. I mean, they don't really have a lot of tangents that they can go off on. It's the villains that don't really have the rules. They're the ones that you can write about, and you don't really have to have any rules with that, when you write about them at all. So how about, you know, so when you're sitting down and you're thinking about, you know, the villains that you're going to have within your book, how much thought do you kind of put in, and how dark do you decide that enough is enough, that you don't want to maybe overstep a boundary with them just because you think it might be a little too much?
You know, I'm not sure I have a rule about that. What I will say is that with stress tests, I tell it from multiple points of view. There are different scenes are from different points of view, and I start off very quickly with the point of view of the kidnappers. Then there is somebody who's behind them, but there is someone who is behind Mr. Big, if you will, and that isn't revealed until the end. As it progresses, I begin to get a feel, and I don't know how else to describe it, but I begin to get a feel with how bad these people are, whether they have feelings that can redeem them and so forth. And other than saying that it's just a matter of feeling my way along until it seems right is about all I know to do. I agree with you. There are lines that you don't want to cross, and there's lines that when you cross them, you say, uh-oh, no, I got to back up and do this differently. But I'm not sure I have a rule on it so much as just a feel.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, when you know, when you're going through and you're kind of feeling, you know, you're kind of feeling your way out, it does make it that a little bit, I guess. You know, I mean, it's difficult enough to write a book, and then when you have to kind of, you know, get everything wrapped up together and make everything kind of work, I guess you just kind of know about it, don't you? You just kind of have that feeling that you just know that you did it correctly and that this is the way it's going to be.
Yeah, I think you do. Now, as you well know, there's all kinds of writing software that helps you to keep things straight and keep things straight and so forth. Confession time, I don't use any of that. I keep it in my head, I juggle it, and at the very end, I've got to make everything come out right. Occasionally, I will leave an end untied, leave it just up to the reader, was this a good guy or was this a bad guy or was this good or bad and so forth. But by and large, you have to provide an explanation for almost everything. And sometimes you get fussed at for too much. As you know, we're not supposed to use what's called deus ex machina, God out of the machine, which means that at the very end the cavalry rides in. But sometimes the hardest part of the whole book is knowing how to wrap it all up and tie up all those loose ends and not forget any along the way.
Yeah, when you started on this journey back and you know, now that you're five books into writing, you know, your fifth book and you're into this thriller and suspense genre, is this what you have envisioned exactly, like when you were doing characters and when you're doing plots, this is kind of what you wanted to have done? These are the books that you know that you've always wanted to write?
Oh, gracious, no. I've had a very convoluted journey. The Reader's Digest version is that my wife of 40 years passed away in 1999, and I used journaling afterward to help recover a little bit, and someone looked at that journaling and said, you should turn this into a book. I did attend a writer's conference and did a lot of studying trying to figure out how to write a nonfiction book, and that was published, The Tender Scar, Life After the Death of a Spouse. But at the same time, I came under the influence of some people who said, you know, you're about to retire from medicine. Why don't you give a try at writing fiction? And I tried this and I tried that, and I wrote for 4 years and four novels and 40 rejections, including, God help us, Cozy Mysteries, and that was a real flop. But eventually I found that, you know, I had read suspense and mysteries and thrillers all my life. Maybe that's what I ought to be writing, and I practiced medicine for almost 40 years, so maybe I ought to do a medical work, and I just kind of fell into the genre of medical fiction, and that's how I got there. But my intention was to retire from medicine, sit out on the front porch in a rocking chair, and if I got bored, I might occasionally rock.
Right. Right, yeah, I mean, so you can look back and say, so what was harder, writing your first book or getting your medical license?
It's apples and oranges, unfortunately. Yeah. You know,
it's a much different thing.
Yeah, I was a professor at Southwestern Medical School for 10 years and was back there just last week for a meeting and commented to one of the faculty members, you know, I couldn't get into this institution now. that was so long ago. We didn't use leeches, but it was almost that far back.
And now that you wrote your fifth book this is your fifth book stress test, have you decided that, you know, all your other books were kind of standalones, even though, like we talked off the air, you know, they mentioned that, you know, they wanted to put a series on the Prescription for Trouble series, and they put them on, they just wanted to name them something. Have you decided now, are you going to think about writing an actual series, maybe making, you know, your characters, and you're just going to make your character go forward, or are you still going to be in the standalone category, and you're going to go that way?
Well, let's put it this way. The people who sign the paychecks for their advances, the publisher says that they really like the standalones, and my feeling is that if they like the standalones, that's what I'm going to write.
That's what they're going to give them.
Yeah. However, I'll say this. My next book is already in the can. It's edited, and everything is done. It'll be coming out in October from Thomas Nelson. It's called Heart Failure, and I'm just completing the first draft of the one that comes out in a year, and all these are standalone, and now I've got to come up with a proposal, and I'm very seriously tempted to go back and pick up Dr. Matt Newman a couple of years later and see if I can't use him again, because there are some people who say when they finish stress tests, oh, I'd like to know how his life goes after this is over. So I put it this way, I'm open to it. Publisher has to be open to it.
Yeah, I mean, if they start getting a lot of letters and fans start writing in saying, look, we want more Newman, we want to know what's going on, because you can only wrap it up so much, you can only tie up so many loose ends with one book, that there's always going to be people who are like, well, what happened here, or what's going to go on here, or what about this part? So I think that in the future, I think that we will definitely end up seeing you write more about Matt Newman, because there are just going to be, you know, I mean, there's probably a lot of unanswered questions that people want answered.
Well, probably so, I never know what I'm going to have for breakfast tomorrow, much less what's going to happen subsequently down the road, so we'll see, I guess.
Right. I hear you on that one. I don't even know what's for breakfast, if I'm even going to eat it. You never know. Well, I'll tell you what.
Give me an opportunity, I will.
Yeah, I mean, Richard, I want to thank you so much for coming out and talking about your book, Stress Test, and everything that you got going on, because, I mean, it's just great to be able to see, you know, you just continue going forward with, you know, with what you're doing that's fun, and you're having a great time doing it.
Yeah, it keeps me off the streets and out of pool halls.
That's the good part. So, again, we want to thank you so much for coming on. Keep us up to date on everything that you got happening. And we'd love to maybe have you on when you progress kind of, you know, further with the next one that you said is already in the can.
John, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. You have a good day, Richard. Thanks again.
Thanks, man. Bye-bye.
Well, again, everybody, that is author Richard Mabry, and his website is rmabry.com, MABRY.com, to find out more information about stress tests and everything else that he has going on. And you can check out the series, the Prescription for Trouble series that he had, four books in that one. So we're going to be coming here to our last segment coming up and speaking with author Debbie I'm going to have to ask her off the air how I pronounce it, because I know I just screwed it up. V-I-G-U-I-E is how you spell it. I know how to spell, I just can't say it. So we will be here in a second, and here you go. I can feel no sense of measure, no illusion as we take refuge in young man's pleasure, breaking down the dreams we make.
downtown giving away, but you never came back. No phone, take your place, you know what I mean. We have the same dreams, but you thought it came.
We have Suspense Radio. Again, I'm your host, John Robb, and we want to say that Suspense Radio is brought to you by Suspense Magazine, and we are going to have the May issue out here sometime later today, tonight, so you guys can all check that out. So as I told you before, I knew I messed up for last name, and I do apologize because I wasn't even close. It's Debbie Vigay. She is the author of the book The 13th Sacrifice, which came out last April, but her newest book now, the second book, in the Witch Hunt series is called The Last Grave, which came out in March of 2013. So, Debbie, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
So, again, this is the second book, like I just mentioned, in the Witch Hunt series. And comes forward here with your character, Samantha Ryden, back from the 13th Sacrifice. So, can you give us a little bit more about the book, maybe kind of how things are progressing from first to, you know, from the first book to the second and so on?
Absolutely. Well, Samantha had quite a trying time in the 13th Sacrifice, which was set in Salem. And because of the events there, she ended up having to move away. So she's found herself in the San Francisco Bay Area. You know, totally new life, working with a new partner in the police force there. And she's trying to just sort of put the pieces back together. She's trying to put magic behind her and, you know, reconnect with herself and just try to get her life back as she sees it. But, of course, the universe has different plans. And
right.
She quickly finds herself embroiled in another case that just smacks of witchcraft. And she soon finds herself, you know, pitted against this really dark witch who has incredibly scary powers. And she does, you know, so scary and so intense, she's never seen the like of it. And she slowly comes to realize that both of them are just pawns in somebody else's game. So I had a lot of fun getting to set the book in the San Francisco Bay Area because that's where I grew up. So I used a lot of places that I had been or I knew and a lot of, like, little inside jokes for people that have grown up in the area or have spent enough time there that they'll get what I'm talking about and it'll be funny to them, you know, and it's kind of like little Easter eggs that I enjoyed putting in there.
Yeah, and that's one of the good things is, you know, when you're writing the series, you're able to kind of do a little bit. You know, there's always the debate of series standalone. Series, you can expand the world into a much greater, entity, whereas standalones, it's kind of one and done, and you kind of move on.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a lot more difficult to do series because the world is so much bigger, and you have to keep all these balls floating into one thing, and you can't forget what happened in book one when you're on book seven, and people are going to
right.
think about it. So how kind of has, you know, Samantha, you know, kind of progressed herself from the 13th sacrifice and now into the last grave, you know, just as a, you know, just like the emotional kind of standpoint as a character that fans
exactly.
will notice?
Well, it's actually, the last grave is more of a deconstruction of her character, where, you know, she started off, you think she's got it kind of all together in the first book, you know. Things kind of undo her a little bit, but you're like, well, she'll bounce back. Well, that's not so much the case. And so we get to see her actually devolving a little bit as she's trying to solve this new case and as she's having to delve deeper and deeper into her own past and trying to unlock the memories that she's, you know, not been able to remember, that she's kept hidden from herself from all these years. You know, the big
mm-hmm.
secrets about what was it in her childhood. She obviously knows she had a horrific childhood. The reader knows she has a horrific childhood. But there are clearly a couple of key events that were so terrible, she won't let herself remember them. And, of course, by the end of book two, she remembers them, and it pretty much destroys her, you know, emotionally, psychologically, and everything else. So book three, then, will be putting the pieces back together, figuring out who she really is and who she really wants to be.
And I'm right in assuming that there's really no, like, end in sight, or do you have a specific number of books that are going to be within the series?
The series is currently planned as a trilogy. I mean, if the
okay.
fans want more, I would always be willing to accommodate. But so far, the publisher and I have agreed on three.
Okay, so then everything's going to have to kind of be like, a, you know, like wrapped up here. And so you're going to be bringing all of this excitement and all of this stuff is going to happen really fast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to have to bring it all to a head because you don't want to have maybe the unfinished questions unless you know that maybe there'll be a book four coming out. So, that'll be very interesting in what you have going forward. So you've kind of been, I'm sure book three is probably already done or close to it. Do you start to feel like that sense of separation?
Not quite yet. The first draft of the manuscript is done. I get to see what my editor thought about it in about another week or so. So hopefully she loves mm-hmm. it as much as I do.
Yeah.
But until I'm really done with seeing what the editor, you know, thinks and my responses to that, I'm not going to really feel disconnected yet. There is a sense of relief that I've gotten it all out there. I've put it out on paper, everything that I wanted to put out on paper. You know, I got the story out of my head, which is great. But I'm still
right.
there's still going to be a pretty intense connection for at least another 2 months before, you know, it becomes something that, you know, the rest of the team at the publisher is dealing with, but me not so much.
Yeah. And the one thing that you mentioned is when you know it's a trilogy and when you look at all the trilogies that have happened back in time, the second book, which is what this book is, The Last Grave, you always have the first book is the setup of everything that's going on, but book two mm-hmm. is the one where all the shit happens.
Yep.
I mean, that's where all the craziness goes forward. Like you said, you know, things get broken and she gets battered and beaten up. And then the third book is climaxing it back all together and having to bring it back up. So
mm-hmm.
the action and the pace in this book is probably a little bit different than the 13th sacrifice because this is the book where everything has, you know, everything kind of happens and all the, and everything kind of hits the fan.
It's still a very breakneck pace because that's kind of what I like, you know. I like people to tell me, you know, I couldn't put it down because it just moved so fast. I'm like, good, that was what I intended, but it is certainly darker. Yeah, a lot of people are going to be, oh, the first book was so dark. It's dark in a different way. And you're exactly right about trilogies. I always, to me, you know, given my generation and everything else and the way I see fiction, to me, the middle book in a trilogy is The Empire Strikes Back.
Hey, Luke, I was just thinking, Luke, I'm your father. I mean, that was one of the most defining moments of the trilogy.
Exactly. You have all of the big, horrific revelations right at the end. You have your heroes in extreme jeopardy where you don't know if they're going to make it out. You know, Luke finds out that Vader might be his father. He loses his hand. He gets his butt kicked. Han Solo is frozen in carbonite after he refused to tell Leia he loved her too. I mean, it's the emotional turmoil, and it's the moment of all of the big reveals where you're like, oh, crap, that's what was really going on. So that's what's happening to Samantha. It's that moment at the very end where she finally unlocks that last memory that she's been hiding from herself, and we all go, oh, no.
Yeah.
You know, and we feel for her, the trauma of what it is.
Right. So it's almost like, you know, Pandora's box has opened.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And this is what's been let up. And so when you started back, you know, before you were going to write the series and you did the 13 Sacrifice, have the books kind of progressed in the way that you thought they were going to do, or have you had a lot of surprises along the way in these last couple years with the books?
They have progressed mostly the way I intended them to do. However, I will say that the one twist that is like literally the last page of book two, and we have to deal with it for the first few chapters of book three, I did not see coming. I did not see what was going to happen when she finally had all of her memories back. That totally surprised me when I typed it, and I'm like, and I just sat back and went, oh, that's bad.
Yeah.
Oh, that's dark and that's scary. And then I, you know, kind of stopped and I thought, and I'm like, but I've always been leading here. My subconscious brain didn't tell my conscious brain this is what was going to happen, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's fun when those things happen, but it's also, I guess, kind of scary, isn't it, all at one time?
It used to be scary. Now it's fun because that's what tells me that it's good. When I surprise myself with something, when a character or an event takes a left turn or something happens that I'm writing and then I write something I didn't quite expect to write, or I realize that something has to change from the plan, that's when I realize I'm really, actors would call it, I'm in the moment, where you suddenly make decisions you didn't plan for and you just go with it. And that's when I know that I'm being true to the characters and true to the story, and that's when I do my best writing. You know, so that's always, the first couple times it happens, you're like, oh my goodness, what's happening? But, you know, and it's happened to most authors, I think. You'll hear them talk about the characters take over, you know, things like that. Or the characters start telling them what to do, and that's why we sound crazy as writers. But it literally is that moment where you realize you think you've been heading to, you know, point C, and all along, you've been writing to point M, you know?
Right.
So, it's fun.
Well, and I want to remind everybody here, we're speaking with author Debbie Vigay and her latest book called The Last Grave, which is the second in the Witch Hunt series. It's debbievigay.com, V-I-G-U-I-E.com is your website. But now, fans of, you know, you have other, many other books, you have trilogies, and you wrote many other different, you know, stories. How has the transition maybe been with people from maybe some of your other series, coming over now and getting into the Witch Hunt series, because, you know, you were the co-author of the Wicked series. Have you seen anything different? You've grabbed new fans and stuff like that? I mean, how has all that transition been?
It's been really interesting to actually watch because what I've noticed is, for the most part, people who read young adult books aren't following authors so much as they are following series. I mean, there are a few exceptions, But, you know, it's hard to keep up the awareness of what you're doing. So, I mean, we've had so many people. Nancy and I have written two other series after Wicked. We wrote Crusade and The Wolf Springs Chronicles. I cannot tell you, the third book in Crusade came out in September, and I cannot tell you how many emails I get still today with people going, I just found this series, and I had no idea you guys wrote it. I'm like, really? You know, whereas I've written some stuff for the adult market, you know, instead of young adult, like the Kiss trilogy and things like, and the Psalm 23 mysteries, and they find me right away, you know.
Right.
And instead, but that, the market, you know, the books over there are not quite as intense. Witch Hunt is definitely, it's on par with Wicked for the intensity and the darkness and everything else. And in some cases, it's worse. You know, it's a little more frightening in a traditional way. But I've had so many of my fans of some of my other work say, I was scared to pick it up, but because it was you, I did. And I'm so glad I did, because even though I had to sleep with the light on, it was worth it.
Like, and, you know, and secretly, you love that, though. Don't talk. Secretly, authors love to hear when people write them and they say, oh, thanks a lot for keeping me up all flipping night. I really appreciate it. You're like, yeah, good. That's what I was supposed to do. I mean, I did my job.
That is my favorite thing. I love getting yelled at because I made somebody late for work. I kept them up,
right.
And then they're, like, falling asleep at work, you know, or their kid has done the same thing. I'm like, well, then, you know, clearly I wrote a good book.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of the same thing of even if a fan emails you and says, XYZ character, I hated that character, I wish that you would have killed that character off because they just got under my skin so much. You're like, beautiful. That's exactly, I gave you an emotional connection to it, whether it was bad or good, but then I wrote a good character because you never want it to be forgettable. And I guess
right.
That's the scariest part of an author is to have a forgettable character. You either want them loved or hated. That's the whole idea.
You have hit the nail on the head because people always ask, you know, what are you trying to accomplish with your books? Like, you know, are you trying, what is the message, you know? And I'm like, the message is that I want people to have an emotional experience when they read my books. I want them to feel fear. I want them to feel joy. I want them to run the gamut of all of those things and, you know, be exhausted by the end. But I want them to actually connect.
And so is there a character in The Last Grave, one that maybe surprised you when you were writing them that had a bigger voice than you thought that they might have, and maybe one that you might explore further in the third book that, again, you had no idea that you were going to explore that for that far in the third book?
That is an excellent question. There is the character of the coroner in the second book. She's shows up in person, you know, at the first crime scene, and then we only hear her voice on the phone, for, you know, a couple more times in the story.
Mm-hmm.
She, it's funny because I'm much more of an action and dialogue oriented person, but I got such a clear picture of her as what she looked like. And she's like, it's 4 a.m. and she's showing up to this crime scene. They've clearly got her out of bed and she's dressed to the nines. Her hair is done. Her makeup is done. She looks perfect. She's wearing heels, you know, and she's like the medical examiner, you know. And she's looking at Samantha kind of like, you know, there's never any excuse not to look your best. You know? And she's not saying it to be mean. She's saying it because that's her life philosophy. And she cracked me up so much that I'm seriously thinking of doing a spin-off series just around that character. I'm thinking of having her move to L.A. and become, like, you know, the crime scene investigator kind of thing to the stars, you know?
Like the female Quincy.
Exactly. She's just,
you know, I mean, I've been getting into a lot of those older shows that have a lot of those legs and realize that, you know, here's the thing, and this is the thing that I think that is great about books like yours and authors and, you know, that how you write is that it's the character that you know, that you love. When you talk about CSI and you talk about those kinds of shows, it's always about the plot and what happened. But when you're talking about like a Quincy or you're talking about, you know, a Columbo,
mm-hmm.
it was built around the character and not just so much the plot.
Right.
And that's what I think that people take away. And that's why they love your book so much is because, yeah, it's a great story and a great plot, but it's the great characters, and you were
Thank
able
you.
To pick out that quarter just from the phone call and create those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. That's very kind. But
yeah,
yeah,
I think that you realize that going forward, that that's what it's going to have to kind of be. That's kind of where the directions go.
Yeah, it's you know, people do. I mean, they it's like the characters they either want to be or they want to hang out with or be friends with. And what I've found is oftentimes the primary characters are so important, and you spend so much time trying to set them up, you know, make them believable, give them depth and everything else, and send them on this journey. And yet what surprises me time and time again is it's the secondary characters that you maybe didn't spend as much time, you know, purposely thinking about, that are the ones that steal the show and, you know, become the ones that everyone loves, including, you know, me. And the more I love the secondary character, the more I write for them and the more people rave, you know.
Right.
But it does happen again and again, because people love a good story, but if they love the character, it means so much more. And it will
yeah.
be more memorable for them, and they will come back to read the rest of the books, or they will reread the books. Whenever I have fans who keep telling me they reread the books over and over and over again, oftentimes they're not telling me, they won't even tell me the name of the books that they're rereading. They'll tell me the characters that are in the books that they're rereading about.
Ah.
You know, they're like, I'm reading about Cindy and Jeremiah again. And I'm like, okay, so clearly they're reading the Psalm 23 mysteries, you know, but they didn't say the Psalm 23 mysteries.
Yeah, you've been doing this for quite some time, that I'm sure that you really don't get surprised anymore at the question or how kind of fans react to things that you are like, why are you reacting to this part? I mean, of the book or this and that. And, you know, and it's always just fun when you're writing it and you bring a new book out there and a new series. But there's always a lot of, you know, you got to be a little worried when you start with a new series. Like, how are they going to like it, or what are they going to
mm-hmm.
do? I mean, you always have that kind of, you know, fear inside.
There's always a little bit of that, but this is going to sound odd. I'm very, authors as a whole, as a group, we're very insecure people.
Yes, you guys are. I will give you that one too.
Thank you. And where I find I differ from a lot of my colleagues is I'm not afraid people won't like it. I'm afraid people will never see it to read it to like it.
Okay.
You know, and so I'm more afraid that people will not figure out that, oh, I've got a new series out and they should go look at it. Because I'm confident that if people read it, they'll love it. You know.
And
so
and when you're going through and you're trying to, because, you know, we have a lot of authors that, of course, listen to the show, and you probably kind of, you know, you just kind of touched on a marketing aspect. How has that been for you to be able to make sure that not only people read it, but, you know, kind of getting yourself out there to the crowds and putting yourself in front of the camera instead of, you know, writers. And typically writers love to be behind the camera.
Yeah. Yes, we do. there's
yeah.
a reason we chose the profession we chose, you know. And what I'm finding is more and more in the modern age, with the accessibility of media and social media and stuff like that, authors can't just be at their desks at home. They've got to be out there in the public eye. They've got to be on social media. They've got to be going to conventions, because the value of face recognition is ratcheting up in the modern paradigm. You know, and that's interesting. It's on one hand, you know, it's like, okay, great. If that's what I've got to do, that's what I've got to do. And I don't have a problem with it. On the other hand, it's occasionally, it occasionally is very inconvenient or very startling, you know, because you don't go into this career expecting people to recognize you, but if people recognize you, you will do better with your career, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I was talking with Lee Child one time, and he said, and you know, all the books he wrote, and now he has Reacher, you know, the movie and everything else, he's been
mm-hmm.
recognized one time on the street. Somebody came up and stopped him and said, are you Lee Child? So, you know, I mean, he wasn't, you know, besides really like maybe Stephen King, who has a very recognizable face, I guess you want to say.
Right.
It's very difficult for you guys to maybe kind of be, you know, out there and recognizable and have people, like, know you when you're walking down the street and, you know, TMZ is taking pictures of you and post you on their website saying what you're drinking for, you know, Starbucks. I mean, those are kind of funny things, but the creation that you do is kind of, I guess, the reward of not the face recognition more along the lines of, but it's the recognition of just, it's kind of hard to say. I mean, just reading your books and having a lot of interaction is a lot better than, I guess, the Hollywood kind of celebrity fame that, you know, that maybe some people think that authors get, which they really don't get.
No.
You know, but you go to any place, and what do? You see them all sitting around the bar drinking. That's what they all do.
You know? I will say I have had a couple of encounters.
At the bar?
No, in like usually in bookstores with fans who went totally crazy on me, which is
crazy,
awesome.
Like crazy,
but it was like one of those
how?
Things where you're like, do I need to call security?
wait. So you mean they like attacked you? Like, you know, like,
yeah.
Oh my God, I love you so much, or
yes.
Blah, 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 or...
My personal favorite was actually a bookstore employee, and I showed up at the bookstore as a surprise, and I needed to get a book for a friend because he needed a copy for somebody else, and I didn't have any more, and I figured I'd sign stock while I was there, so I just marched up to the front counter to introduce myself, and there was like three women there, and one of them vaulted the 4.5-foot counter, slammed into me so hard, into my chest, that she knocked me backwards into the stacks of books, and I ended up on the floor under her and under the books, and she was screaming like a banshee the entire time. And I'm like, is she trying to kill me? What's happening?
Oh,
what's
my
happening?
God.
You know? And like, people are trying to help us up, and I'm like, what's going on? You know? And she's like, and finally, she becomes coherent, and she says, you're my favorite author. I'm like, so you're not killing me then. So this
okay,
is not... This
well,
is not...
Yeah. It's like, well, thank you for that, but I got to breathe.
Yeah, I'm like, wait,
I'm
bruised.
I'm not
writing
anything else. No. Wow.
That
yeah,
was the best one. But, I mean, I've had people grab onto me. Like, I had a librarian have to, like, practically peel somebody off of me at a book talk. You know, they're like, you have to stop touching her now. You know? And I'm like, thank
hilarious.
You, because I didn't want to say anything, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's hilarious.
It's a strange beast. The entire industry is weird. I mean, there's people that are like, who are you? And then there's people like, oh my gosh, that's who you are. And you're like,
yeah.
All right.
Well, I'll tell you what, Debbie, we want to thank you so much for coming on. And, you know, we have just run out of time here on the show. And, again, the book is The Last Grave, and it's the second in the Witch Hunt novel right here after 13 Sacrificed. And so I'm sure your next one's going to be coming out about the same time in 2014 to finish up the trilogy.
Yep, and it'll be awesome. And thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you again. And, again, it's DebbieVega.com, or did I say that one right? Or did
no.
I screw it up again?
Vigay.
Vigay, Debbie Vigay, that's right, Risque Vigay. DebbieVigay.com, VIGUIE.com to find out more information. So, Debbie, we want to thank you again, and we'll talk with you when the next book comes out.
Great, thank you so much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
So, again, everybody, we want to thank so much for all the authors that we had on the show today. We have come down to the end of our fun 2 hours here. We are with Michael Stanley, Ted Kotzkama, Richard Mabry, and Debbie Vigay. So all the authors that we have, you know, check us out, suspensemagazine.com. If you have any questions, you can always email us about the show. If you want more information, we will give you whatever we can, and you can do that at editor@suspensemagazine.com to continue forward on, you know, like I said, with the show, the magazine, or the publishing, or anything else that we have going on. The schedule coming up here is going to be for May 18th. We are going to have, is our next scheduled show. And then June 1st is going to be a big show that we have here, and then it's going to start getting a little bit sparse through June and into July because we have some things. We got some vacations coming up, and then we're going to Thriller Fest here in July. So we're going to be a little bit sparse, but check out the website to see what we got coming up here. And we're going to start filling the schedule in. We are starting a new show that's going to be coming on Sunday mornings. It's going to be Suspense Radio One-on-One with authors that are on tour with the Partners in Crime Association. You can check out Partners in Crime Tour if you're an author. They are a great organization. Again, if you want more information, you can always email over to us, and we'll help you out with anything like that. So, again, and we'll see you guys all in a couple weeks with our next show, and we want to thank you guys all for listening. Whew, it's definitely been an exciting time that we've got coming up. So, everybody, again, thank you so much for listening. I'm your host, John Robb. This is Suspense Radio, the best suspense show where you can hear your authors in the mystery, thriller, horror, suspense genre. See you guys all in a couple weeks. Enjoy.